monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. I'm one of your hosts, Shannon Grimes, and I'm joined by my co-host on this show and in life, Blaine.
Hi.
This month on Real World Rewind, we're hoping to shiver your timbers with our discussion of the first installment in the Pirates of the Caribbean quintet, or whatever the term is, for five movies.
We're going to go with quintet. And for the record, the Shiver Ye Timbers joke, we fully embrace how corny that is in the spirit of the movie. And if you loved it, then Shannon gets all the credit for the delivery of that. And if you hated it, it was actually my suggestion. We do it in the first place. So either way, Shannon is off the hook or gets all the credit. So we're good to go there, right?
Win-win.
Right. So our movie for this month, Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, which was directed of Gore Verbinski of Mouse Hunt fame, and more recently, A Cure for Wellness fame or ill repute, was released in the summer of 2003. It's got quite a cast, this film does. It stars, of course, Orlando Bloom, who was wildly popular at the time of release because of his portrayal of Legolas in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the third installment of which was coming out that December. So this was right in the midst of all of that craze.
Did you remember the purses? Mrs. Orlando Bloom, yes. Purses everywhere.
Yeah, so this was right. This movie
didn't have one of those, for the record.
Excellent casting to capitalize on Orlando Bloom's fame there. The movie also stars Keira Knightley, who we'll talk about a little bit later, Johnny Depp, and Jeffrey Rush. And again, that's just to name a few. The film was written by six people, whose names we will not list just for the sake of time. And then, of course, last but certainly not least, the film was scored by Claus Bedelt, who is a colleague of Hans Zimmer. And I think that may be worth pausing on just for a second, because this feels like a Hans Zimmer score, does it not?
Because it feels amazing. It's like probably the best score in it's debatable, but it's one of the best scores in movie history, and it feels very similar to Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, it definitely has a Hans Zimmer feel
vibe.
And vibe and inspiration. And I think because he did produce the score, he's listed as a producer. I think his name is usually bigger than Claus Bedelt's on all of the soundtracks, everything, which makes sense because you're trying to sell discs. But actually, there's a bit of interesting history about the scoring of this film. Originally, they had another composer set to score the film, and I cannot remember his name right now. But because of scheduling issues, it didn't work out. And they needed to get a score composed very, very quickly for this film. I think it was 3 weeks or something like that.
Holy cow.
So they tried to call Hans Zimmer in, because why not? and Hans Zimmer was actually working on scoring the Tom Cruise film, The Last Samurai, at that point, and didn't really want to take on composing another score at that time because of, again, time commitment issues. And so he actually pointed Gore Verbinski to Claus Bedelt, so the story goes, who was a colleague of his, a younger colleague, and Hans Zimmer was sort of his mentor. And then I still actually believe that Hans Zimmer wrote most of the main themes, if not all of the main themes, for this film. So that's why it feels very much like a Hans Zimmer film. And because it's sort of a Mr. Miyagi-Danielson relationship in this with this
ship off the old block.
Right. So Hans Zimmer did actually write some of the music for this, at least the main themes. And I believe he also wrote most of the main themes for this song in the score of one night, he said. In the space of one night,
that's
he
incredible.
Says.
I can't even
Again,
imagine.
Rough. Like, very rough, just to give Claus Bedelt something to go off of and give him a vibe to sort of build on. But and there were a lot of other composers who actually came in and worked on this film, again, because they were trying to do it in such a time crunch. But I think it's worth just even at the outset, you know, saying something about Claus Bedelt, because this is a great score, and I feel like all too often Claus Bedelt's work here gets overshadowed by Hans Zimmer, even though Hans certainly did have a hand to play in it. So.
Yeah. Well, it looks like, as I'm looking this up, Claus Bedelt actually has quite the filmography under his belt. He was involved in The Gladiator and Pirates and Mission Impossible, and he helped score Room that won a bunch of Oscars a couple years ago, and some other stuff that I haven't heard of. But, like, he's involved in pretty big stuff. I guess I just never really heard of his name.
Well, and I think prior to 2003, the films that he worked on, he was kind of in the music department, was doing various things, but he wasn't the main composer. And so I think Pirates really jump-started his career, where people started to pay attention to him and say, this is someone worth...
Definitely.
Worth, you know, taking a look at. Exactly. So, Klaus Badelt and Hans Zimmer, the score for this film is fantastic, and we'll talk about that more in just a second. Let's kick off this episode in full by sharing a little bit of our overall reaction and thoughts on this film. So, Shannon, you hate this movie, right?
Oh, yeah, it's the worst. I'm just kidding. Calm down, everyone. Don't throw your phones at anything. No, this is a great movie. It's fantastic. I love it. I laugh every single time at all the jokes, even though I've heard them upwards of 20 times. I've watched this movie a lot, like almost close to the number of times that I've watched Tangled. That's pretty high.
That is saying something.
That's quite a bit. No, I love this movie. It came out when I was in fifth grade, and I'm pretty sure I didn't see it then. But I remember everyone in my class was like going around quoting it. And so I actually knew probably 10% of the movie quotes before I had even seen the movie. I got it for my 13th birthday as a gift from my sisters because it's PG-13 and it was my first PG-13
movie. It's a big deal for you. Yeah.
Yeah. And, my sisters did one of those wrapping things where they wrapped it in like 25 layers of tissue paper and then more boxes and everything, and put it in this enormous box. Like, I thought surely I was getting, I don't know, a bicycle or something. Like, it was huge. It was just this DVD. That's what I remember about it. But the movie inside was great. And so I've always enjoyed it. I think it's really clever. I love the writing and the witty banter and the acting, and the score really is what does it for me. I think I also fell in love with the score because we played it a lot in orchestra.
Yeah.
The violin part is spectacular.
Yeah. I love this movie. I love, love, love this movie. Really, all of the movies in the series are guilty pleasures for me. But I love, love this movie. And I am ridiculously excited for...
Number 5.
Dead Men Tell No Tales, I think is what the subtitle is. But yes, number 5. I cannot wait to see number 5, which is coming out later this month, of course, which is why we're doing this movie now. but yes, I adore this movie. I think it's so much fun. And since we both love this film, let's talk a little bit about why this movie sticks with us, why it resonates with us, why we have a lot of fun with it. You mentioned a few things. I really appreciate how this movie takes every single cliche, every single rote trope, and just runs with it and has a blast with it. I soak all of that up. I just think it's a lot of fun. And I give a lot of credit to my appreciation for this film to Johnny Depp and his performance. I'm not a big Johnny Depp fan in general, but I will watch Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow any day.
Yeah, definitely. I think that he's a really great actor. Like, he does his roles so much by his expressions and his body language. He's just really, really into every move and little movement of his mouth and everything. Like, he is really spectacular at it. But I think that other movies, most of the other roles that I have ever, like, seen the trailer for him playing are pretty dark movies. Like I'm just not really like a Sweeney Todd, like Edward Scissorhands kind of girl. Like, I like fun movies. I mean, I'm not ditzy, promise. But I prefer movies that are fun over just like really dark, brooding movies. And I think for the most part, he plays kind of darker characters, and I'm sure he does a great job with them. I'm just not interested in the movies.
I don't like dark movies either. Or sad movies or anything like that. So,
Yeah, he's lying through his teeth.
No, but I'm like I said, I'm not a huge Johnny Depp fan usually, but I think he is made to play this role. It seems like anytime I see him in almost any other movie, he is Captain Jack Sparrow, just with a little bit of a twist of some sort. Yeah. And like you mentioned, there are tons and tons of reaction shots in this movie where somebody will say something, and then the camera, Verbinski just puts the camera on Johnny Depp and lets him react facially, like these, you know, raising his eyebrows, these little, you know, ticks of the face or something like that, doing that great drunk look he does.
Because he's drunk during the entire movie.
And it's so much fun to watch. Like, I love watching, in every single shot that Johnny Depp is in, I love watching him here, because this is just such a great performance
for him. The confusion.
Yeah. And his, it feels weird to talk about someone's hands like this. But I love the way he uses his hands this movie.
Like, no, that's a huge part of his acting.
This very, like, they're always out in front of him, and he's usually got, you know, using his pointer finger and his middle finger to, like, loosely, like,
point gesture.
Yeah, exactly. I love the way he uses his hands in this movie. It cracks me up. And it gives life to this character. Of course, his body language, that walk that he,
the drunk walk.
Yeah. When I saw this with my friends in the theater, we spent a lot of time after that, you know, perfecting our Captain Jack Sparrow walk and slur and everything. That was a big thing we did.
Such a guy thing to do.
it was a big part of our summer after we saw that movie. So, it was a lot of fun. I do think Johnny Depp is meant to play that role. So Johnny Depp just makes this movie for me. I can hardly imagine it with anybody else playing that part, but really it's a solid cast overall. I mean, so Keira Knightley, stars in this movie.
She's a really good actress. I really like her. I know that part of it's just like, she's so pretty and like dainty, but I think she's a really good actress.
See, I think that's funny. I'm usually not as high on Keira Knightley either, but I really enjoy her in this film. And I think she fits the type that she's playing pretty well and does a good job with the role. And really, this is the movie that made her. I mean, Keira Knightley is sort of a mainstay now,
right?
But this is the role that put her on the book. Yeah. She had been in a few other things, but I mean, she was in Star Wars, for crying out loud. She was in The Phantom Menace she was in The Phantom Menace as Queen Amidala's what do you call it?
Oh, like her mate, her
bodyguard. Yeah, the one who impersonates her. I believe that was Keira Knightley.
I'm going to look that up.
I know she's one of Queen Amidala's cohorts.
Hold on.
She's definitely in the movie. Not a big part. So she had been in things before.
I did not know this.
But this was the role that got her in all the other leading roles. This was what put her on the map. So this was a big thing for her. And then, of course, Jeffrey Rush is a great addition to have, because he's this very well-versed stage actor who's done many, many films, and again, a lot of theatrical work. And he really does a great job with his character. Why am I forgetting his name right now?
What's Barbossa.
Barbossa, yeah.
Sorry, I'm looking this up.
He's fantastic. And so I really appreciate the cast overall. I think this is a very well-cast film. You had mentioned, too, as we were watching the movie, how beautifully shot it is.
Oh, yeah. No, there are, like, sunset scenes everywhere, and it's just really bright. It just, like, every scene is that's supposed to look some way is over, like, dramatically, which is in a good way, not like soap opera drama, but, like, it's just so obviously beautiful, or, like the sunset scenes are so beautiful, and then the scenes where, you know, they're in the jail or something, like, everyone is so dirty. Like, you just almost feel dirty watching them, because mm-hmm. their faces are, like, dripping with dirt. And it's just, it's so exaggerated that it makes you feel almost like you're there.
Right. And when Jack Sparrow and Will Turner, when they clash swords for the first time, and it's in the blacksmith shop, Will Turner picks up the hot iron to sword fight with it for no other reason. I mean, I know it's because there's nothing else around, but for no other reason. For no other reason than that allows for sparks to fly as they clash blades. Like, that's the kind of movie this is, and I love it. I absolutely love it.
Okay, she played Sabe.
Yeah.
Sabe.
Yeah, I think that's her personal guard who impersonates her. Sorry. So, yeah.
Continue.
I did know that. I got my Star Wars down.
Didn't know that.
I have a Star Wars podcast. Did you know that?
Yeah, y'all. Look it up. Home One Radio.
But it is a beautifully shot film. The DP is Darius Wolski, who shot recently Prometheus and The Martian. I guess Prometheus isn't that recent now, but yeah, some beautiful imagery in this film. I really like, I'd forgotten how much I like the underwater scene where the pirates all, the undead pirates all go walk underwater.
Yeah, and then they're like switching between their skeleton selves and their not skeleton selves.
Yes, I love that when they're fighting and when Sparrow and Barbossa are fighting, and occasionally in that cave where the treasure is, mm-hmm. they'll go from shadow or from skeleton to person, from skeleton to yeah. person. That's really cool.
There's like one shot where I know they specifically, you know, did that with the set to line up a bunch of spotlights so that they'd switch it out, be, you know, dark light, dark light, dark light, dark light, in like the series of 10 or 15 seconds or something, so you can just watch them changing back and forth.
Yeah, and technologically, this film was pretty innovative at the time. I remember being wowed
I'm sure.
at this movie when I saw it in theaters. So it's a beautifully shot film. We've talked about the score a little bit already, but
it's great.
Shannon basically hums the entire score for 2 hours. 2 hours and 2.5 hours when we watch this movie.
I'm probably not that fun of a person to watch movies with, but I really like scores. I like music a lot.
So Shannon was in orchestra in high school. Why is the violin part? She plays violin, still does.
It's really, well, violins get the melody most of the time, which is always really fun. And it's just, you get to use a lot of different techniques in that one. Like, there was a lot of quick little strokes, and then there were some, like, long melodious parts. You get the dun 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 dun, and, like, that's, like, quick and fast and gets your adrenaline, and then you get the doo-doo, like,
yeah,
it's just a nice range.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun, and for the record, I wish everyone could have the chance to watch a movie with you to hear you hum, because it's a lot of fun. You don't do it when we're actually in the theater, though. So
I do it when I know a movie's.
Yeah.
When I know the score, and so like watching a movie that I've watched many times at home, I just can't help myself.
Yeah. Well, so we love this movie. Any small or big criticisms of this film you want to mention?
I mean, it's not that important to me, but, like, personally, I don't think Orlando Bloom is that fantastic of an actor. Like, yeah, he's pretty, but he's just not, he's not my favorite, like, I don't think he uses emotions as well as Johnny Depp. So that's kind of the only thing that I really have noticed that's, like, per se wrong.
Yeah, it's, with it. It seems like Hollywood would agree with you to a large extent, and I think that's evidenced by the fact that, so we're talking about a guy who played Legolas, right, in the most popular movie trilogy of ever.
All time.
And he's in, what, three of the four of these movies? Of the five?
I haven't seen the third one, so I don't know.
Yeah, he's in three of the five, I believe. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong, shout out. But
I can look it up.
So he was in these big roles, and he's in nothing. Like, what is he playing? What is he doing now?
He's in some little romantic comedy with Kirsten Dunst that wasn't very good.
Right, I mean, this is a guy who had every opportunity to make it big, and he's just not doing much anymore. I think that's because he's not a terrific actor. That's just speculation. It could be because he just really wants to do the small indie roles.
He's in the new one.
Oh, is he? I haven't looked that up. Okay, spoiler alert. Sorry.
Sorry. If he's, like, supposed to die or something in one of the movies, I'm sorry we spoiled it for y'all. I haven't seen the third one.
So yeah, I mean, he's not in a ton. Of course, they brought him back for the Hobbit movies and everything, which, again, was a thing. But he just hasn't made much of what he's been given in terms of big blockbuster roles. So, yeah, it seems like a lot of Hollywood would agree with you, or the casting directors would, at least. So yeah, it seems like a valid criticism. I think my one criticism, which is not... Okay, so again, this movie is very conventional, and that's not a bad thing. Again, I love it. But it always kind of irks me, because it just seems like the change of heart that Elizabeth Swann's father and Captain Norrington have at the end of the film is just so, so, so dang abrupt. And I get it. They see her willing to sacrifice for this, you know, for this pirate. and whatever. And so that moves them and all. I get what's trying to go on there, but it's just, man, it's just, it's just so quick.
It seems like, I understand her father more than Captain Norrington, but I feel like if he was, really in love with her, he would have been more upset that she didn't love him back and, tricked him into saving her beloved as a wedding gift.
Or is it true love that he's just willing to let her go? I guess he could be a truly he could be a truly noble
maybe
person.
Maybe he's he probably, if that's the case, he's the best person in the movie.
Exactly.
He is the most loving, but I don't know what it is.
I guess you could make a case for that. It's super, super abrupt, and that always just kind of irks me a little bit. But again, overall, I'm just head over heels for this film, and I can hardly countenance criticisms.
It's just so fun.
It is. It's a blast. Well, this movie is obviously, again, the epitome of a popcorn flick. But, of course, that in no way means the film is devoid of interesting themes and ideas. Because, after all, like we always say here, entertainment is not mindless, right?
Right.
And I actually think that this movie hits on a theme in particular that we discussed in last month's episode on The Fast and the Furious. And namely, that is class conflict. This movie has quite a bit to say about social classes and codes, as it were. The world we get in this movie is a extremely stratified society, yes?
Yes. There's the three levels. You have the nobility, you have essentially royalty. We've got Elizabeth's family and the military, and they're up there at the top, and they've got servants and coals in their bed and stuff. And then you have the regular people who are in the shops and the blacksmiths and the bakers and stuff, and they're they're normal people. They're kind of dirty. They probably don't have any kind of commode. They're just doing their life. And then you have the lowest of the low, who are the pirates. Which I guess is just everyone's fighting them, and
they have their own city, Tortuga.
Oh yeah, they have their own refuge because they can't be anywhere else.
Yeah, and so we see this in a number of different ways in the film. Elizabeth Swann is obviously supposed to marry Norrington, and the reason she's quote unquote supposed to marry him is because she can't marry Will Turner, who she actually loves, because of social status, and. This stratified, class system is so built into the society and the culture that it's not even considered, really, that Will is an option.
Yeah, right? Except by the maid.
Right.
The maid thinks he's a fine man.
And again, because the maid is not of that same class, right? So
and that's too bold, miss.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what Elizabeth says, in case you don't remember, when the maid says, that Will Turner, he's a fine man, too. She goes, that is too bold. And then the maid is like, I'm so sorry, and she leaves.
And we see Elizabeth Swann at the very start of the film. She's someone who is literally constrained and constricted by the social norms and customs.
By whale bones of corsets.
Yeah, so that corset scene is, is set up there at the beginning of the film. For a very good reason, because, again, she's literally, tied up in this system, and it's...
She's not it free!
Causes her to pass out. And fall off a cliff in spectacular fashion.
Leading to all of the events. If her father hadn't given her that dress, none of the movie would have happened because that medallion would not have hit the water.
Yep.
It's all his fault.
It is. And, honestly, so there are those three broad classes. There's almost, again, a little bit of a class within a class where among the sort of citizen class... There are the shop owners who seem to be a little bit higher than the workers, like Will, because it seems like when Turner presents Norrington or Swan's father, I can't remember exactly who it is, with the sword at the beginning of the film.
It's the governor. It's her father.
Yeah. He wants to thank the blacksmith, whoever the guy is who owns the blacksmith shop, and not Will, who we assume made it.
Right. We know that Will made it because his boss is sitting there drunk.
Yeah, that's
passed
right.
out in the shop.
That's right. So again, Will is even a little bit lower than than the citizen class because he's just a worker, right? He doesn't own anything.
Yeah.
So
even though he does the work.
Yeah, even though he does all the work. And that's a joke that's made several different times. I mean, the drunk shop owner comes in at the very end of the Turner Sparrow fight at the beginning of the film and you know, hits Jack Sparrow over the back of the head with his whiskey glass and then gets all the credit for stopping it. When obviously Will was the one who was there fighting and everything. So again, social class is a big deal. And then even the pirates, right, have their own social code, right? So there's obviously the nobility have a code, you know, as to who you marry and everything, but the pirates also have their own code, which they follow diligently throughout the majority of the movie. What is their code? It's not leave no man behind. It's
the opposite of that. It's if a man falls behind, he is left behind. Which I think Will kind of takes advantage of, like,
mm-hmm.
I thought that was funny because when he learns that, when Jack tells Will that that's the code, Will seems kind of, you know, surprised and upset by it. And then 10 minutes later, when Jack falls behind, he's like, oh, he fell behind. We have to leave him. Like, he's taking advantage of that. Turning into a pirate.
Yeah. And so, bridging off of this, that there is one major theme in this movie. It seems to be that it takes someone operating outside the bounds of law and order, or outside of the social classes, in order to be able to save the day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Ultimately, the people who are operating within the social order, whatever it is, they're not able to do anything. They have to transgress that code mm-hmm. in order to be able to get anything done. I mean, so we see Elizabeth Swann abandon her code, right? I mean,
right. I mean, she's practically stripping in the, you know, in the middle of all of these things in order to get to the places that she needs to. She sheds her dress several times in the movie. And that's, you know, that's a big, like, no-no in that time.
Yeah.
Can't shed your ankles.
Yeah.
So, And
yeah, you know. So she hates the corset. She hates that kind of dress, right? Because it's constricting.
Right.
And then obviously she loves the farm boy. And that's a big no-no, right?
Yeah.
And loves pirates, which we'll talk about more mm-hmm. in just a few minutes. She's fascinated by pirates, which someone in the higher class shouldn't really be fascinated with pirates at all. But like a lady certainly shouldn't be fascinated with pirates. That's a bad and dangerous thing.
Yeah, well, now that I'm thinking about more ways that she abandons her code, even, you know, it was strict enough that she shouldn't have even been honestly talking to Will when she sees him in the morning and she comes downstairs and she's like, oh, I'm so glad you're here. I had a dream about you last night.
Oh, right.
And her father's just like, why are you talking to him?
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, Will calls her Miss Swan and so that he doesn't get in trouble. And her father's like, well, at least he has a sense of propriety.
Right.
Can't believe you're talking to this man. Like, it's just very socially unacceptable for her to approach a man and talk to him of probably a different class.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, in order for quote-unquote good things to happen, you have to transgress these laws and operate outside the system. To quote Lonely Island, you can't be a part of the system.
Threw it on the ground.
And then, of course,
know what we're talking about, look it up so that we don't look like idiots.
Without kids around, if you're going to look that video up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, not family friendly.
It's called I Threw It on the Ground by Lonely Island. Not safe for work or young ears. And that's your real world theology recommendation. There you go. We're family friendly here. The pirates even abandon their code, right? Because ultimately they realize, I mean, Jack Sparrow's crew, they're like, well, we got to leave him behind because he fell behind. That's the code. Stick mm-hmm. to the code. But ultimately they say something like some transgression is necessary or piracy is necessary or something like that.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what the exact words of, the governor are.
Yeah.
But at the end of the movie, he says something to Commodore Norrington, like, in the rare event that doing the right thing requires an act of piracy, piracy itself can be the right thing.
Yeah.
And so.
That's much better than I remembered it.
I mean, that's close.
Yeah, that's close to what it says. That's a good paraphrase. That's like New Living Translation good. Like, that's It'll get you there, even if, you know, you're not...
you got the spiritual message of that, y'all.
So, yeah. Everybody's transgressing their codes. Will is transgressing his codes, too, because he's a social climber. You know, he wants to marry up. But then he's also a... like, he willingly identifies with the pirates, too, which is...
to save the woman he loves.
Exactly, exactly. And I think... so in a way, this movie, I don't want to say that it advocates anarchy is too strong, especially again because this is a big popcorn flick. But it does seem to be very much a rebels movie.
Yeah.
It
encourages you to look at the social norms surrounding you. And determine whether those are actually helpful or harmful. And I think in some ways, you know, that can be good. Like, think about students looking at what's going on in their school. Like, all these kids are doing things that they shouldn't. Like, is that a helpful thing for you to do or not? And, you know, that's a helpful way to look at it. But it could also be not good in It could be a
harmful
thing. Thank you. With, you know, people trying to just do everything themselves.
Yeah.
So there are good and bad things about it.
And again, there are two extremes in this movie. You have, even though they are both codes, they're very different codes. So there's the extreme legalism in terms of the nobility, and there's the extreme lawlessness in terms of the pirates.
Right.
Right. And so they're, you know, they're both
meet in the middle.
And I think for us as Christians, some Christians struggle with the lawlessness thing, antinomianism and whatnot. But for a lot of us as Christians, we probably struggle with legalism a little bit more. We probably identify more with nobility, maybe not in terms of the race or class issues as much. Although I think that's there and maybe just under the surface a lot of times. But I think even it can be easy for us to fall into legalism, and I think this movie sort of gets at the dangers of a legalistic society, mm-hmm. right? Because it's almost
pharisaical,
right? I mean, as Christians, we know that God's law, right? We know that God's law, especially as it's revealed in the Old Testament, is there for a number of things, but. Mainly, really, to be a mirror to lead us to Christ. That's what Paul says. Paul says that the law is there it's a tutor, even to lead us to Christ, right? It's a mirror to show us our sin, right? It's there to point us to Christ. And it shows us our weakness, right? Right? Yes. And our inability to please God on our own. And as Christians, and as people, we're prone to legalism a lot of time. We're prone to want to make rules for ourselves that we can check off and say, okay, I did this, so I'm a good person, or, you know, I'm okay, or whatever this is. And as Christians, I mean, Christ came to free us from the burden of the law, right? I mean, again, this is a lot of what Paul is saying in the book of Romans. But then, of course, Paul also says that as Christians, we're not under the law anymore. We're not condemned by the law because Christ came and fulfilled the law for us perfectly. Right. And died in our place, took the punishment of our law breaking, and bore that in himself on the cross. But we aren't without a law, right? As Christians, we're not antinomians. We're not the pirates, right? So we're somewhere in between. If we're looking, we're not the nobility where we're just, you know, stuck to this moral code that ultimately leaves no room for life. And, right, we're not stuck in a corset, if you will.
Thankfully.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly don't want to see me in a corset. So we're not under the law, but we're also not completely without the law. But Paul says we're under Christ. We're under the law of Christ, right? And so we're thankful that Christ has come and given us freedom from our guilt, right?
Exactly.
And from our sin. But we don't want that to lead to lawlessness. And I think this movie, again, in its very popcorn flick sort of way, it opens up avenues for discussion about that whole
right.
debate about law and lawlessness, right? Well, and Christ's work.
Yeah, I mean, even thinking about just the example of like Jesus picking wheat on a Sunday. You know, he was technically working,
exactly.
But he wasn't breaking the law because he wasn't breaking the intent of the law. Like he was, you know, feeding himself, and he can heal people on a Sunday because, well, because he's Jesus, and that's important. But but I think it's important for people to think about the intent of the laws. And like, I remember some sermons that we've listened to about things, even regarding, you know, like head coverings for women or something. Like it's important to think about what that was intended to say in that culture, and not be super legalistic about things that we don't know the intention of now.
Yeah. So yeah, this is a useful movie to start those kinds of conversations. And again, I think I'm sort of more identifying, again, in my wrongdoing with the nobility, and certainly not the pirates. If we're using these as a spectrum of legalism or antinomianism, lawlessness, right, on both ends of the spectrum. And I think that varies from Christian circle to Christian circle. So I come from a more, at least in the past 10 years or so, come from a more reform background. And so reform people generally tend to struggle with legalism more than they do antinomianism, as a general rule. And even that, there can be some variation in there. But I'm going to go with that. And then it seems, you know, other circles can struggle with antinomianism to a certain extent, or lawlessness, living. Those would be the people who would just say, well, Christ has come, he's died for us, so we can really do whatever the hell. Heck, we want. but yeah, so we've got Lonely Island, cursing. This is a good episode of Real World.
We're gonna have to put like a censor warning. Do not listen to with children under 8.
So anyways, I think if you're interested in having conversations about this movie, this could be maybe a useful place to start. And again, I apologize that my thoughts are not. I took a long time, a very winding road to get there.
Roundabout.
And I ask for your forgiveness because it has been a long day. But we are recording, and we're pushing through. Done with my meta moment. But while we're on this topic of discussion, getting right to the heart of this. This film's depiction of a strict commitment to keeping code or legalism, if we want to put it in that sense. Right at the beginning of the film, we also have an interesting issue highlighted surrounding parenting and censorship, which is something you brought up that I didn't really think about. You just brought it up immediately, so explain.
Yeah, well, I had never really noticed that before, but I've seen this movie so many times that I'm constantly learning new things. Another great reason that it's a great movie. But just right there at the beginning, you know, Elizabeth singing about the pirates, and Gibbs comes and talks to her about it, and then Norrington tells her the pirates are evil, and man, I can't remember the governor's name. I'm just going to call him the governor. Comes over and says, stop talking about this. I'm concerned about the effect this will have on my daughter. Which, you know, in a way, it's fine. Like, you don't want your kids exposed to terrible things necessarily, but at the same time, well, okay, no, like, you don't want to make your children go through bad things, like, there's that, but I think that there's something to be said for introducing things to your children when you are there and can discuss it with them and can talk about it, you know, in the light of Christ and what all he's done for us, instead of just letting them figure it out for themselves. Because obviously Elizabeth figures pirates out for herself, but she, you know, didn't have her father's talking with her about that in kind of a healthy way to discuss, you know, why it's bad and what it will actually do to you. And I think there's something to be said about, you know, anything that we would not want our children to see. And we're not parents, and so, you know, we can't 100% guarantee this or even guarantee it at all. But I think that it's something to look for, to be able to talk about difficult topics with your child, because they're probably going to find out about it from their friends if they don't have, you know, if they don't have someone to talk about it healthfully with them.
Yeah, and I mean, so we don't have kids, but this is, we, Lord willing, will one day, and this is something we talk about quite a bit, because obviously we watch a lot of movies, we consume a lot of pop culture, and we you know, read a lot and all this stuff.
And I'm a teacher, so I know kids.
Exactly, exactly. So these are things that are, we wouldn't presume to teach, tell anybody how they should parent their kids, because we don't have that wisdom, but these are issues that we're some, you know, involved in to a certain extent, and we're certainly thinking about. And I think, again, if we're looking at this movie and it's sort of character sets on a spectrum of legalism and lawlessness, the problem, it seems like, with legalism in terms of censorship is that it makes something so completely forbidden that you can't even mention, you can't even utter it, right?
Well, and then it seems more enticing.
Right, exactly. So it makes sense. It makes sense as a parent that the governor wouldn't want a young Elizabeth hanging out at Tortuga. Right, and that makes just sense.
Engrossed in this.
Or even out on the deck as they fight pirates or anything like that. That makes sense. Seems like good parenting to me. but to just jump on her immediately when she even says the word pirate or shows a little bit of interest doesn't seem like it's going to keep her from being fascinated.
No, like she's interested in it, and she's going to be interested in it whether it's forbidden or not.
Right. So... anyways, that's another conversation that you can have. Again, hope we're just opening up doors, and we're certainly not trying to tell anyone how to parent their kids. But I think this issue of legalism and lawlessness, this is certainly something that seems to be very much at the center of this film, and it gets to it in a number of very interesting ways. But I do think that we've gone long enough for this episode, and it's certainly been a wild episode. Thanks for bearing with us, even though, again, I feel like I might have been a little bit more rambly than usual. Maybe not, but we're tired. And
if at this point you haven't figured out how to listen to 1.5 time,
yeah,
this would be a perfect time to do 1.5 time.
Got this on 5 time. I sound like the chipmunks.
Thank you for listening.
So, Shannon, why don't you wrap up this month's episode?
Okay. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We want to hear what you think about The Curse of the Black Pearl. The easiest way to do that is by joining the Real World Theology Discussion Group on Facebook. Also, if you've enjoyed the show, please take a second to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. That wraps things up for us here. So until next month, thanks for rewinding with us.
Now bring me that horizon.
Yo ho, yo ho, a pirate's life for me.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!